Can you believe that?
Okay, our next speaker. It's my great honor to introduce Dr. Robert S. Gould, our finest speaker. He was the founding dean and currently the chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Statistics at the School of Public Health at the University of Maryland, College Park. He's also a professor in the Department of Epidemiology and Public Health and Department of Medicine at the School of Medicine, the University of Maryland in Baltimore. He's the co-director of the University of Maryland College Park Center of Excellence for Health Information and Technology Research and director of the Public Health Informatics Research Laboratory. His own research focuses on health communication and technology development and evaluation in public health, and he showed me how to operate this machine here today so we could move ahead. So thank you for that. His presentation is entitled Positioning Social Marketing on the Nation's Health Agenda, Looking Forward. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Gould.
Good morning, everyone. It's a real pleasure to be here along with my colleagues, and this meeting, though winding down, has been an exciting one. I do wish to disclose that I don't have anything to disclose, although I will tell you that the presentation I'm going to make is an opinionated presentation, and these opinions do not represent any agency that I've ever worked for, or currently work for, but are purely my own. And I hope you appreciate that, because just a couple of things. In 1983 through 1986, I worked in the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion. I was the evaluation monitor on the first generation of the national objectives. I oversaw national school programs from that office. I worked on an interagency task force with then all 14 executive agencies on how to coalesce around this national agenda. But the opinions I'm going to express, and they'll be clear that they are opinions, don't represent that office directly, but come as a result of my having spent now nearly 30 years, connected to the national objectives in some way. Now, we had our introduction to social marketing from the panel, and last night I tried to actually correct this picture by putting Bob Marshall's picture up there, or a circle with a line through it saying this is not Craig. But we've heard a lot about the objectives and social marketing, and now what I'd like to do is sort of take a generational snapshot of the national objectives for the nation from my perspective. This is a slide that is produced by Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's from the Healthy People Consortium Toolkit. And it provides you the generational changes through each generation of the objectives for the nation. But let me back up to 1977 when all of this started. It actually started in Alma-Ata, Russia, at a meeting sponsored by the World Health Organization, which resulted in two critical things, one of which was something called Health for All by the year 2000. Some of you are familiar with that document. It now is in its third generation or fourth generation. But shortly after that, the United States began to think about a national program of objectives that would define our national agenda. I can still hear Michael McGinnis, the director of ODPHP at that time, voice in the back of my head, because I've heard him say it so many times, this is not a federal agenda, because the federal government can't throw enough money at all these things to make all of this work. This is a national agenda and assumes that virtually everyone in some way who is a stakeholder from any sector is going to recognize that they have a role to play to make this work. But the first generation of objectives in that were released in 1980 with an endpoint in 1990 had originally 227 objectives. But if you look at all the documents now, you'll only see 226. One was removed because of politics in the middle of the decade. And after I'll tell you which one anyone would like to know, which one, because it was all about the Reagan administration and their belief about health that changed this agenda after it had been released. But the interesting thing about the 1990s was that it started in a crude way by saying we ought to have all these objectives. They all ought to have certain characteristics. They need to be stretch objectives. They really need to push us. They need to be important. They need to be measurable. And fourth, achieving them should not depend upon some science fiction technology to be invented in order to accomplish it. So they had to be achievable given sound science. They had to be measurable. By the middle of this decade, we realized in our mid-course review in 1985 that only about 35% of the objectives actually could be measurable, even though that was an expectation when they were all written. That changed the nature of how we viewed the nation's objectives. But I also want to say one other thing. They brought the best minds in the world together to craft the 1980 release of the 1990 objectives. They wanted it to be the national agenda. And if you look at the original document and the entire agenda, the best minds, nowhere in that entire document is the phrase HIV or AIDS. And yet, starting in 1983, a short time after this agenda was released, the national agenda had to change. It had not been anticipated. That's one of the majestic things about public health. We have to be prepared to change on a dime, no matter what our underlying priorities are, to address things that nobody could anticipate. Another thing we didn't anticipate in the first generation is that there was baseline data for the entire population and targets for the entire population. In 1985, Mrs. Heckler released the Secretary's Task Force report on black and minority health, and we said, oh my goodness, not everybody starts at the same place. So when Healthy People 2000 was released, we had an incredible increase in the number of priority areas. It went from 15 to 22 priority areas. We went from 226 objectives to 312 objectives. And what we now had was a recognition that not everybody started in the same place and that we needed subpopulations in our national agenda. So we put subpopulations in Healthy People 2000, is the first time they appeared. We put in differential baseline, but you'll also notice if you go back to that document, there are differential targets. The thinking was, if you don't start at the same place, you can't get to the same place. So let's have realistic targets. Well, that was the thinking until Healthy People 2010 was released, and largely because of the influence of Dr. Satcher, who was both Surgeon General and Assistant Secretary for Health. He said, you know, what it's really all about in terms of health disparities, that phrase that we used to use that's now being replaced with health equity, what he said was that if we think about Alma Ata, health for all by the year 2000, what did that mean? Did anyone think we could have health for all by the year 2000 when that was released? Do you think anyone thought that was possible? No. However, the thinking then was, and the thinking in crafting Healthy People 2010 was, that unless we commit to getting everybody to the same place, we will never exert the political will necessary to make it happen. And so if we set differential targets and we achieve them, we have not achieved what we really need to achieve. So we have to state that even though we have differential starting points, we have to say that everybody gets to the same place at the end. That's the goal. Not to have disparities after working so hard. Healthy People 2020 expanded the scope of the nation's agenda, but it did many other things. It now made data available to you, to everyone, in a new infrastructure being provided by the federal government to have access to data in real time, something that was never really available to us because of weaknesses in our technology infrastructure. But let's think about what happened in the last 113 years. Think about change. This is not as stark a pointer as I thought. Think about change in the 20th century related to communication, technology, transportation. Not too many years ago, this is Neanderthal, but the life expectancy was 30 years. But if you come forward to 113 years ago, life expectancy was about 40 at the beginning of the 19th century. We doubled life expectancy by the end of the 20th century, and just think about all the things that it took to do that. However, one thing we know that it took to do it is that it wasn't advances in medical and clinical sciences that produced that doubling of life expectancy. Instead, it was recognition of the need for early intervention and for positive pregnancy outcomes, fluoridation, immunization, physical activity, better housing, better eating. Those were the things that allowed us to double life expectancy. Now, I would argue that nobody's going to double life expectancy again. Human body in its current form will not live for 200 years. And we're up against something called compression of morbidity, compression of mortality. But we still have advances to be made, and we still have gaps to close. Now, many persistent problems remain, and you're aware of them. Disparities, tobacco use, unhealthy built environment, chronic disease management, and on and on and on. But the bottom two on this list, utilization of both evidence-based practice principles and recognition of the importance of practice-based evidence, are beginning to emerge. Larry Green is one of the most vocal people about this. He will say, if we want better evidence-based practice, we need more practice-based evidence. Not from randomized controlled trials, but from real-world examination of what happens. Now, I call these wicked problems. This is an actual phrase you can look up, wicked problems. Wicked problems are defined as those problems that are social, cultural, difficult, or impossible to solve for a number of reasons. There's incomplete or contradictory knowledge. They require people from multiple disciplines. The magnitude of the burden to achieve outcomes in these problems are significant. And their interconnectedness, none of them are siloed. They're all connected. They have determinants that are connected inextricably. An example of this for me, many of you will recognize this as the Washington metro area subway system, the metro. It has four lines. It has a red line, a blue line, an orange line, and a green line. This is downtown D.C. This is the border of D.C., surrounded by Virginia and Maryland. Now, if I get on the red line over here in downtown and take it just 17 miles, the difference in life expectancy of the people who live here to here is 9 years. If I get on the orange line downtown and travel out to Vienna in Virginia, the difference in life expectancy in a 10-mile radius is 8 years. If I get on the blue line from here to Foggy Bottom to Springfield, Franconia, 12 miles and a 9-year difference in life expectancy, and the green line from downtown to Prince George's County, where I live, is 17 miles and a 3-year difference in life expectancy. Place matters. We're beginning to realize that with the social determinants, it's about more than we ever thought about before, and they're all tied together. We have to think differently. So I'd like to share a philosophical dilemma I continue to have. Anyone who's ever seen me do a presentation will probably recognize the next three slides because I try and put them in every one. On July 20th, 1969, at 3 a.m. Eastern Time, an American stepped foot on the moon. And some of us got to watch it on television. I actually did watch it on television. I thought it was live. I learned later that it was on a time delay. Because if something dramatically bad went wrong, they didn't want anyone to see it in real time. Now, it took enormous compute power to put a person on the moon, to calculate trajectories, orbits, and everything, navigation systems, life support systems, enormous compute power. But we now know that the cell phone that you carry has more compute power than was used in the entire Apollo moon mission. Think about that. We now have the capacity to put all of the technology power that put a person on the moon in the pocket of 5 billion people. That's the state of the art today. It's in their pockets and on their bodies. Nobody leaves home without two things: a set of keys to the house and your cell phone. So, if we can land here with the technological equivalent of an abacus, then why can't we apply today's technology tools to solve problems like this? I don't get it. I don't understand it. We've been talking about this for 40 years. A lot of people think this is a new issue. It's not. We've had this kind of technology for a very long time. It's evolving and continues to evolve. We're talking about public health 2.0. We probably ought to be talking about public health 3.0 now. Citizen journalists, citizen scientists, crowdsourcing, less control by central authorities. Privacy is not the showstopper it used to be. People are willing to give up information. Just look at Twitter, look at Tumblr, look at Facebook. Look at the information people are willing to give up. We have a mashup culture that allows us to connect databases in ways that have never been thought of before. When you hear the term big data, it's not about massive data. It's about how to make sense out of data sets that were never intended to go together. That's what is the real issue with big data. Not massive amounts of data, although that's important. But it's combining data sets that were never meant, never designed to go together. Now we're talking about a data lake with all kinds of sources of data coming into this lake and trying to make sense of data. Ubiquitous computing, public health toolkits for communities, they're all over the place. Now, I'm a founding dean of a school of public health. I served as dean for 10 years. There are five core disciplines that the Council on Education for Public Health insisted everyone in public health be exposed to. You know what they are: epidemiology, biostatistics, behavioral science, community health, health promotion, environmental health, health services and policy. Five core disciplines. Yet, IOM, several years ago now, said there's at least eight other major competencies that everyone in public health ought to be exposed to: informatics, genomics, communication, cultural competence, community-based participatory research, global health, policy and law. We need to change our view of the training and shape of schools of public health, programs in public health, and accreditation for public health. Did I say that? I did say that, didn't I? So, as for the future, we need to extend our reach and toolkits in ways that actually are reflected in some of the things you heard this morning. We need to use new strategies and recognize healthy people is here to stay, but it's going to continue to evolve. Every generation is going to take advantage of the previous generation, the lessons learned, and reshape itself. And as soon as it's released, you can count on it. Within a year, 6 months, 2 years, something's going to change the agenda, and we in public health had better be prepared to deal with it. And we'll be prepared to deal with it if we realize that the old view of public health is not sufficient in today's world. The rapidity of change will continue. Wicked problems become more clearly identified and actually called wicked problems. Pre-service and in-service training needs to evolve as healthy people will evolve. Core disciplines of public health will evolve. Practice needs to evolve. Our evidence strategy for getting best practices needs to evolve. Can't be dependent upon randomized clinical trials anymore. Not entirely. Our future holds the following: ongoing technology capacity, a redefinition of public health core disciplines, the need for more comprehensive practitioners' toolkit. We need to examine a toolkit that takes us from social engineering to social marketing, and everything in between. We need to know how to shape policies, how to shape environments, how to shape laws, how to shape regulations, how to shape people's wants, how to respond to people's wants, how to understand all of these things in order to address the unanticipatable, wicked problems that we will face. I changed the language here only because it's such a familiar thing. Einstein said that it's insanity to continue doing things the way we've always done it and expect different outcomes. We need to evolve as a profession, just as healthy people evolves. And the tools that we provide, pre-service, in-service, and through health departments, voluntary agencies, NGOs, need to evolve with this. And so, you know, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then you begin to define every problem as if it's a nail. Every one of us can't have a single tool in our toolkit. We need to be prepared to work with lots of different strategies, work with lots of different groups. Ultimately, I think social marketing will be seen not as a critical communication objective or part of that, but more importantly, as one essential component of public health infrastructure that crosses all priority areas. It'll be recognized as a tool for all priority areas. I'm going to stop there and say thank you. This is all the people who have presented their email addresses. Please do also recognize that a couple of us are willing to tell you our Twitter handles, and you should use them. I've been asked to make two other announcements. University of South Florida actually does, and I have no financial commitment here, no connection. The University of South Florida has an online social marketing graduate certificate, online and in person, and the 23rd Social Marketing Conference in Clearwater will be held next June 18th through the 21st. And there's information up here about both of those things. Thank you all very much.
Well, we've certainly gone from soup to nuts today in terms of putting all this into context. We have not quite 15, but very close to 15 minutes left. And so we wanted to give you a chance, thank you, by the way, for holding your questions, but give you a chance to ask any questions. If you don't mind, if you ask a question, just say who you are. So we, please, go ahead.
The theory base available to social marketing has to and will continue to change over time. That's my expectation. I think academic centers will contribute to that, but I think we will miss part of the point that I was trying to make if we don't take advantage of real-world experience outside academic centers and join those in communities in partnership to try and understand not just what we're doing and what are the outcomes, but to understand and see if we can tease out the theoretical underpinnings of why something works and how we can prove it. So, but I'll turn it over to
Okay, go ahead, Brian.
So in terms of where we're, what direction we're taking it, South Florida. The framework that we've been developing called community-based prevention marketing that teaches community coalitions how to take a social marketing approach on their own to create change in their own communities. The direction it's going is started with program work, so teaching community coalitions how to do social marketing or programming. Then the next iteration of CBPM is for policy development. We're kind of wrapping up that work now and getting ready to launch a training website for Coalitions Anywhere. But then where the next direction is we're taking it, CBPM, community-based prevention marketing for systems change. So we're bringing in systems science next. So that gets the wicked problems that Bob's talking about. You can't figure wicked problems out with a linear logic model that says input, activity, outcome. Things are too complicated. There are feedback loops. So that's the direction we're going in. If anybody else has a direction that they see or are taking it in, we'd love to have you chime in as well.
Okay. Anybody else? Tally? Or anybody? Is there another question?
Okay, let's go right over here. Go ahead, and then we'll go to you. And then
I'm Mary Ellen Eisen. I run a local nonprofit foundation. Dr. Gold, since you've been involved with these healthy people initiatives, do you think Americans are getting healthier with these initiatives over the last 30 years or not?
That's a wonderful question. I think that there's substantial evidence that Americans are getting healthier in some ways. I will tell you, though, that healthier as measured by longevity up until now is a marker of healthiness, but I'd rather have an increase in quality of life in those extra years, and that's where we're not doing as well. We do have some improvements, but here's the tragedy that I think we're facing. It's become increasingly clear that childhood obesity, violence, and a variety of other of these wicked problems are combining in such a way that it appears that the increased trajectory of life expectancy is going to turn in the next generation, and that our children and grandchildren will probably have a shorter projected life expectancy than we will. And the best evidence of that, I think, is Mike McGinnis and Bill Fagey published an article called The Actual Causes of Death in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1993 and then revisited in 2001 or 2002, I think. And basically, if you ask anyone what are the top 10 causes of death, they would say things like heart disease, cancer, and so on. The actual leading causes of death, as we all know, are sedentary lifestyle, tobacco use, and poor food choices, and a variety of things like that. Behavioral kinds of things over which we have so many subtle ways to deal with. And tobacco is still the number one preventable cause, but that's soon to be replaced, I believe, in the next generation by sedentary lifestyle and poor food choices for many people. So are we getting healthy? I think we have been in the last 113 years. I think we're beginning to realize that may change unless we figure out a way to deal with some of these wicked problems more effectively.
Great. We have a question here, and then we'll go ahead.
Well, I want to know what objective was taken out.
All right, I'll share this with you. Again, this doesn't represent federal or official policy. There were 227 objectives, and they were broad-reaching objectives. One objective was, and I don't remember the exact wording, but it's close. One objective was to reduce the number of second trimester abortions from this to that by 1990. The Reagan administration felt that if there was an objective supporting a reduction in second trimester abortions, it might give the impression that first trimester abortions were accepted. And so that objective was removed from the United Nations agenda. Don't share that with anybody.
Back here, go ahead. Please.
My name is Gail Melton, and I'm giving a social
measuring it through those 8 indirect benchmarks.
Yeah.
Sorry,
no.
Yeah. Well, it's a good question.
Are there other questions? Any last comments from our panelists?
Thank you for coming.
That's a good way to end.
Okay.
Email us if you